Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm not sure if you can hear me. Now you can. I want to welcome you to this current events roundtable on America and the world. My name is Fred Logevall, and I'm the director of the Mario Einaudi Center for International Studies here on campus, and I'm also a member of the History Department. And I'm just delighted to see all of you here this afternoon. Lots of possibilities competing for your attention. And also pleased to see that we have a nice sunny Ithaca day for this event. And also want to very much welcome our two panelists. I'm so pleased that they agreed to join us today, and I'm going to introduce them in a moment. Just want to say a few words about the Einaudi Center. I think many of you are familiar with what the center does. It stimulates, it supports, it coordinates Cornell's long-established work in and about the world. And it seems to me that that international dimension has never been more important than it is currently for Cornell, and indeed for all major research universities in this country. And what's it seems to me, as director, is very important to note is both that Cornell has a very long history of international engagement, going back, as you know, to the very first class, which contained students from half a dozen different countries, right up until today. And it seems, I think, to many of us that higher education is becoming increasingly global, both in terms of the production of knowledge, and I suppose you could say the teaching of that. More than ever, research universities, as you know, recruit a higher percentage of their faculty and their students from abroad. Cornell is no exception. And I want personally, and I think I speak for the higher administration, President Skorton refers often to a global Cornell. I believe that Cornell should be the exemplary transnational university in an increasingly interconnected world. And this, it seems to me, is where the Einaudi Center has a very important role to play. What the center does is it provides a dialogue that cuts across disciplines. One of the real hallmarks of the center is its interdisciplinary nature. We have 21 affiliated programs, each one of which has made, I think, a very important contribution to Cornell's reputation abroad and that reputation for excellence, and in terms of teaching our students, which after all is our primary mission here at Cornell. We have, depending on how one counts, we have between, say, 650 and 800 faculty members who are affiliated in one way or another with these programs in the Einaudi Center. So we're talking about a very large number of faculty who are in all the colleges on campus. And in addition to these things, in addition to serving as a kind of umbrella organization for 6 area studies programs and then 15 other thematic or development programs, Einaudi does a number of other things. We support faculty grants and student grants. A lot of student support, including Fulbright and Fulbright Hayes, are coordinated through our office. Dissertation fellowships. We have an international relations minor, which is becoming more popular among undergraduates, and we hope to build on that strength and make the IR minor stronger still. We have a current events class that we teach each year, and that Professor Judith Reppe will be teaching for us this fall. So there's a lot going on. And finally, the center has its own initiatives that I just want to refer to very briefly as we begin. We have a foreign policy initiative that has attracted a lot of outside speakers to campus and that has been generously funded by donations from Cornell alumna. And we have a Bartels Fellowship every year, as I think many of you know. We have numerous other distinguished lectures that Einaudi itself coordinates. And we have something called the Lund Critical Debate. We have the fall debate already scheduled, and we'll have more information on that debate upcoming, but it'll be a debate on Obama and his place in the world, touching on, in fact, some of the themes that we'll talk about this afternoon. Very excited about that. And finally, we have, as part of the university's strategic planning, we at the center are also involved very much now in thinking about the center's future and what we want to do, what place we want the Einaudi Center to have on campus. Our location is quite perfect in the sense that we're geographically very much in the center of the campus, I think one could say. And we want, of course, also to have that kind of central place in terms of the intellectual mission, in terms of what scholarship is produced and what teaching is done on the campus. So more information about that is to come. But I'm very pleased to be serving as director. I've just been doing it for about 5 months. Very much looking forward to all the things that we have upcoming. Today, we are talking about America and the world, as you know. I think it's fair to say that for the past 18 months, foreign policy has not been a priority for this administration, I think, or at least has been a secondary concern for President Obama. In spite of the still hot wars, the wars that remain hot in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite problems regarding nuclear diplomacy with Russia, simmering crises in North Korea and Iran. Quite understandably, the American economy and the problems with that economy have taken precedence. But we are also all mindful of the fact that foreign policy remains very important in terms of America's both short and long-term future, and that this administration faces very important choices ahead. And I'm just delighted that we have with us today Professors Jonathan Kirshner and Elizabeth Sanders to discuss these issues. I'll introduce Jonathan first. He is director of what used to be known as the Peace Studies Program here at Cornell and is now, if you're ready for this, the REPI Institute for Peace and Conflict Studies, named after the aforementioned Judith REPI. Jonathan is also a professor in the government department here at Cornell. His primary field is international relations, and his research follows two broad themes, the political economy of money and monetary politics, and second, the intersection of political economy and national security. Kirshner's first book, Currency and Coercion, the Political Economy of International Monetary Power, which appeared in 1995 from Princeton University Press, integrated these two interests with an exploration of how states can and have manipulated international monetary relations to advance security-related goals. His second book, Appeasing Bankers, Financial Caution on the Road to War, also from Princeton in 2007, considers how financial interests and international financial markets can shape and constrain states' grand strategies. He's also the author of numerous articles, has edited several books, and is, as I said, also directing the new REPI Institute for Peace and Conflict Studies. I'm delighted that he's with us today. Elizabeth Sanders is also a professor in the government department here at Cornell. A wide range of intellectual interests Elizabeth has, including American political development, social movements, economic regulation, the presidency, bureaucracy, foreign policy, monetary politics, and parties and elections. She's the author of several books and articles, including most recently a piece in Perestroika called Work That Counts, and In Defense of Periodization in American political development, and is working on a book that I'm very much excited about, Elizabeth and I have talked about at great length, which will deal with presidents, war, and reform. In one form or another, I suspect that book project will come up in today's discussion when Elizabeth speaks in a few minutes. And that book will look at the contribution of presidents to major reform legislation and U.S. foreign policy choices between diplomacy and war, and investigates the relationship between major organized groups and presidential actions since the turn of the 20th century. Very pleased, as I said, that they've both agreed to join us this afternoon. And here's how we're going to proceed. They will each speak for about 15 minutes, and I'm going to be quite draconian on the time limit, whereupon we will have perhaps some give and take between the two of them. Maybe I'll enter a question or two for them, and then we will open it up for discussion and from questions from all of you. So I encourage you to take either mental or written notes, and then to commence firing from all sides once we get to that particular part of the discussion. And I'll make sure that we have ample time for that discussion involving the room. One thing that I would ask you to do at this point, I should have said at the outset, is if you have a cell phone, and this maybe includes me, let's make sure that it's turned off for the duration of our session. And once again, welcome. And what I'm going to do now is turn it over to our speakers. Thank you. Jonathan.
Thanks, Fred, for that overly kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, especially to see a lot of familiar faces. Today's topic, America and the World, Emerging International Political and Economic Challenges for the Obama Administration, that casts a pretty wide net. And so in these short comments, I'm going to kind of hone in on one relationship in particular, arguably the world's most important bilateral relationship, that between the U.S. and China. And in that context, I'm going to talk about how the economic crisis has affected that relationship, and indeed international politics and economics more generally. In the spirit of Alumni Weekend, I have subtitled my comments, Money, Sex, and Power. Elements of the U.S.-China relationship, I think, have been affected by the crisis. As a bit of a spoiler alert, I must confess that the rest of the talk doesn't quite live up to that subtitle. Before I turn to my more prurient themes, I want to emphasize that I continue to see, as I have for several years now, some of the most dangerous problems in world politics deriving from a shoe that has not yet fallen, domestic economic distress in China. China's economy is characterized by a number of fragilities, in particular challenges managing massive rural-urban labor migration, environmental and logistical bottlenecks, a still suspect and immature domestic financial sector. Compounding these problems is the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party, and that's the name of the outfit that runs the place, rests on its ability to continue to deliver very high rates of economic growth. Any disruption of this is likely to cause domestic political pressure and upheaval within the country that could easily lead the CCP to search for an outlet in externally oriented, virulent nationalism. So as we think about the nature of U.S.-China relations, we want to keep in mind this danger, which we have not yet seen. Okay, but on to the fun stuff. Money. Sadly, I meant exchange rates. One consequence of this crisis is very much likely to be increased exchange rate conflict between the U.S. and China. This had been a source of friction for some time, and it will continue to be an even greater source of friction as a consequence of the hardening of the perspective of both sides, the U.S. and China, in this conflict. With the recession in the U.S., the domestic politics of the U.S. trade deficits and imports from China leads to very easy finger-pointing on the part of American politicians with regard to the undervalued exchange rate of the RMB. China, on the other hand, while receptive to the idea of some currency appreciation, sits out this economic crisis thanking its lucky stars that it twice ignored pedantic lectures from American authorities and economists whose wisdom delivered the financial crises of 2007 and 1997. And China is more than ever likely to move cautiously when it comes to questions of financial liberalization, having experienced both of these episodes. And this is going to be a really tough nut to crack. Even without the financial crisis, exchange rate conflict between the U.S. and China was likely to prove intractable. Why? Basically because both sides are essentially right in their perspectives. On the one hand, the RMB is artificially undervalued, probably by at least 20%. And it is so by interventions made by the government that are clearly inappropriate by the definition that the IMF has of inappropriate exchange rate intervention. The problem is the Chinese are right when they say that even if China revalues the yuan, the motivating problem will not go away. That is, exchange rate adjustment will not solve the trade imbalances between the U.S. and China. Episodes from U.S.-Japanese relations in the 1970s illustrate this same phenomenon clearly. Faced with a flood of cheap Japanese imports and unfair trade competition from Japan, the U.S. pressured intently Japan to appreciate its currency. And from 1971 to 1978, the yen appreciated. It doubled in value from 360 to the dollar to 180 to the dollar. Nevertheless, trade remained imbalanced. And this pattern recurred in the late 1980s and early 1990s with new U.S. debates about Japanese exports undermining American industry. These exchange rate movements failed to resolve the trade deficits, but they did contribute to some malaise in the Japanese economy, which has been observed by China. And U.S.-China exchange rate conflict will prove even more intractable. Although the RMB is indeed undervalued for a host of technical reasons that if you're desperate to hear about, we can talk about in Q&A, exchange rate realignment will not make the very large U.S. trade deficit with China go away. According to one authority, RMB adjustment alone will not be sufficient to reduce materially China's current account surplus. Another authority concludes, China's exchange rate policy has only a modest influence on the U.S. overall trade deficit. These panda huggers I'm quoting were, in turn, the U.S. Treasury Department and the Congressional Budget Office. China will also have a greater ability to resist American pressure than did Japan, especially after one or two exchange rate modifications fails to solve the underlying problem. Given the attractiveness for China of a stable exchange rate to serve as a nominal anchor for its otherwise unbridled economy, sensitivity to its own domestic financial uncertainty, and skepticism regarding U.S. economic advice, China will eventually dig in its heels. The financial crisis has made it more likely that such a conflict would indeed spin out of control, an exchange rate conflict between the U.S. and China, contributing to a lose-lose trade war between the two states. While this is not necessarily the most likely scenario, again, I do expect constant, sustained exchange rate conflict between the U.S. and China, and just like the U.S.-Japan relationship, it won't solve the trade deficit. Unlike the U.S.-Japan relationship, it will be a conflict that takes place not between military allies, but rather between political rivals. However, I do want to take a moment to be somewhat dismissive of the idea that China holds this kind of nuclear option, that it can dump its massive holdings of U.S. Securities and therefore win any economic conflict with the United States. This is largely an empty threat. China has now what we can call buyer's remorse with regard to its vast dollar holdings. But it did not accumulate those dollars as an act of philanthropy. Rather, it was part of its strategy of economic development, and it currently finds itself as a major stakeholder in the future of the U.S. dollar and in the future of the U.S. economy more generally. One can imagine scenarios in which China will throw caution to the wind and press this nuclear option, but that is what it would be akin to doing. It would be using an instrument that would damage both sides, and something I think extremely unlikely, short of an armed conflict or threats of an armed conflict between the two countries, perhaps imaginably over a confrontation regarding Taiwan. Otherwise, this too is likely to simply be a source of irritation between relations between the U.S. and China, which brings me, of course, to sex. By sex, however, again, sadly, I mean China's increasing sex appeal. The global economic crisis and China's relatively early and rapid recovery from it has only increased China's attractiveness in the international system. In international relations, we have a very nice theory about this, about how asymmetric economic relationships in particular can provide an imposing coercive lever for any great power, because interrupting that relationship can empower the large at the expense of the small, because the small are so utterly dependent on the economic interaction with the large. And thus, threats to interrupt these relationships accrues power to great states. But in fact, more interestingly, and somewhat less talked about, is an element of this theory that is less about coercion and more about influence. And it is this element of economic relationships that will enhance China's international influence in the coming years. As many studies have shown, behind the headlines and with little fanfare or even strategy, the pattern of international economic relations affects domestic politics, which in turn can shape the perception of states' national interests. Important and expanding trade relations between states shapes the way in which they understand their interests in the world. In particular, states that export more and much more to others place an increased value on that partnership and see their interests as converging with those of their growing partners. As famous social scientist Albert Hirschman once observed, business groups will exert a powerful influence in favor of a friendly attitude toward the state upon which their economic interests depend. Moreover, as these relationships are sustained, they actually reshuffle the balance of political power within states, again, remolding the way in which states themselves interpret how best to advance their political interests in the international economic system. One important political consequence of the current crisis is the fact that China has, so far, recovered quite rapidly from it. This is important for a number of reasons, two of which I'll pick up on later: its effects on China's hard power and the perceptions of its attractive economic model. But I first wish to emphasize this issue of China's political influence. China's quick recovery has only accelerated what was already going on, which is its role as a vital pillar and cog of global economic growth. China is a crucial market for the world's exports. We hear a lot about China's exports abroad. It is commonly reported in the media how China is now the world's second largest economy, or how it has surpassed Germany as the world's largest exporter. For much of the rest of the world, the more important story is China's increased importance as an importer of other countries' products. In 2009, China surpassed Germany to become the world's second largest importer. China imports over $1 trillion worth of other countries' goods. In 2008, China was the biggest export market for, among others, Argentina, Chile, Iran, Kazakhstan, Oman, Yemen, Burma, Taiwan, and South Korea. South Korea, which exports twice as much to China as it does to its military ally, the United States. China was the second most important destination of exports from countries including Australia, Japan, and Peru, and was an important market for countless other states. China's value as an export market in the world is only likely to increase in importance in the coming years. This, then, will accelerate the political power of China without grand scheme or plan, simply by the normal process of business in the international economy. As one study concluded, speaking of Asian countries, they will have a huge stake in China's growth and stability. Essentially, China's growing and important global economic role will enhance for China something very much akin to what Joseph Nye once called, and what I believe Elizabeth is going to talk about soon, soft power. Not forcing others to do what you want them to do, but getting others to want what you want them to want. And this will matter for U.S.-China relations, because that enhanced soft power will ruffle the feathers of American preferences. In international institutions and in bilateral relations, other states will be increasingly sensitive to how those interactions affect their perceptions of China's reaction to them. And the U.S., unaccustomed to this sort of thing will be quite irritated. And this leads us to, finally, power. Again, related to this question of soft power is the issue of hard power and, I think, to an even greater extent, the power of ideas. Hard power is fairly straightforward, and I see my time dwindling, so I will not dwell on the fact that as China's economy gallops forward, simply by spending the same amount of money on defense as a percentage of GNP, its military capacity will expand heartily over the years. Again, China's hard power will increase in the coming years, but I do think that is less important than what I mentioned previously, its expanding economic and political influence. And secondly, the power of ideas. And here I think it's important to remember that in Asia especially, this is the second major international financial crisis in 10 years. It is the second major international financial crisis in 10 years that can be associated with ideas that came out of an economic model of the U.S. and of the International Monetary Fund regarding unbridled financial deregulation that I suspect finally in many corners of the world has lost some of its cachet. You may recall, some of you, that in the mid-1990s, the IMF reorganized its policies to force states to deregulate their capital controls. In fact, in the wake of the international financial crisis of 1997, the International Monetary Fund and the U.S. decided the entire problem was based on, quote, poor public policy in Asia. Alan Greenspan's reaction to the Asian financial crisis was, quote, one consequence of this Asian crisis is an increasing awareness in the region that market capitalism, as practiced in the West, especially in the United States, is the superior model. This doesn't sound particularly clever today, but it remains an article of faith among many. In April 2006, a date worth remembering, the IMF announced the following, quote, the rapid growth of derivative and structured credit markets in recent years, particularly among more complex products, has facilitated the dispersion of credit risk by banks to a broader and more diverse group of investors. This has helped make the banking and overall financial system more resilient and stable. I think for much of the world, this is a story of two strikes and you're out. And I do think that relatedly and more broadly, it is very likely that this economic crisis will present a learning moment in world politics. A learning moment is one in which actors within and states themselves orient and reorient their beliefs, expectations, and behaviors about the way in which the world works. However, I agree with Robert Skidelsky in his excellent new book on John Maynard Keynes that these lessons are more likely to be perceived and acted upon first outside of the U.S. and especially in Asia. And that lesson might be to take two steps away from the kind of Anglo-American vision of unregulated, unbridled, deregulated capitalism and towards something else. And there aren't a lot of something else's out there. In sum, in the wake of this crisis, when I think, as I do on most days, of money, sex, and power, I'm led to conclude that unless the Chinese economy collapses under the weight of its own internal problems, a scenario that should not be underestimated and would not be fun, China will emerge from this crisis relatively empowered compared to the United States, and that this empowerment will likely be a source of an increased political conflict between the U.S. and China and a considerable amount of irritation on the part of the U.S. as it seeks to pursue its interests abroad and finds many states deferential, suddenly and newly, to the way in which China is perceiving how such measures would affect world politics. Thank you.
Well, it's no surprise to tell you that the rest of the world rejoiced at the election of Barack Obama in 2008, and that there was great hope abroad as well as domestically that change in the U.S. presidency would be beneficial for the entire world, that we would abandon our reliance on unilateral force, that we would rediscover the virtues of Wilsonianism and multilateralism, diplomacy, cooperation, and that we would abandon our fantastic trumpeting of the virtues of neoliberalism and deregulation, reminded of our change in the view of the unleashing of creative financial products that Jonathan mentioned. I thought of an honors thesis that I helped to direct, I think, 2 years ago, in which a very, very bright young man wrote about how derivatives would hugely expand the prosperity and stability of the global economy. And then last year, I was involved with, as I believe Jonathan was as well, I was more an informal advisor, I think Jonathan was actually on the committee, another remarkable young student who happens to be French, and his family has contributed so much, they keep Frenching these wonderful students to Cornell, and his thesis was about how the U.S. economy had come to grief and how the Anglo-Saxon powers with their relishing deregulation had sort of brought the world economy down. Things you could just look at the titles of honors theses and see the change in global opinion. So there was so much to hope for in the rest of the world in 2008 that the U.S. finally would sort of rejoin the world community, cease our reliance on military power and our disdaining of global public opinion. And so what I want to talk about today is how those two things interact. The set of charts that you got, and thanks to Heike Michelson for a beautiful job on the handouts from what was originally going to be a PowerPoint. You might see it as an odd juxtaposition, numbers about public opinion, numbers about military spending, but I think these things are very much interrelated. By its reliance of after 2000 on military force, the U.S. sacrificed so much of public opinion and soft power and also did great damage to its economy, which in turn comes back to haunt the exercise both of soft power and of hard power in case we need to exercise that again. Let me give you a definition of soft power that comes from a scholar at Harvard who has done so much to popularize it. His name is Joseph Nye, and he defines soft power as the ability to get what you want through attraction rather than coercion or payments. When our policies are seen as legitimate in the eyes of others, our soft power is enhanced. But attraction can turn to repulsion if we act in an arrogant manner and destroy the real message of our deeper values. With its war-centered leadership, President Bush's first term caused costly setbacks for America's role in the world. And there was only slight recovery toward the end of Bush's second term. The loss of soft power, Nye has reminded us, can damage our influence and our goal attainment in so many different ways. It causes other countries to lessen their cooperation with us in our wars and to lessen their cooperation with us in all sorts of other ways. If their publics are very hostile to the United States, it's really much more difficult for the leaders of other democracies and as well as non-democracies to cooperate with us in all the different arenas in which we would like to exercise influence. And while we were so busy waging war and disdaining public opinion for 8 years, other powers like China, Brazil, India, Europe were waging peace and they were developing their economies and they were learning to get along without us. We heard some remarkable talks at the iNowDy Center, now the REPI Institute. And I remember the image that some of our speakers at these peace studies lunches painted of international institutions being born and being developed, like the International Criminal Court, like the Institution for Administration of the ban on landmines, neither of which we cooperated in. And I think we felt that by not cooperating in those two treaties, we'd keep them from happening, but we didn't. Must have been a shock that they went ahead and did these things without us. And I asked one of the speakers, so what was the role of the United States when the countries got together that had ratified the International Criminal Court and were beginning to build this institution? And she sketched an image of U.S. representatives sort of being in a fancy hotel and having a lot of cocktail parties and trying to get people to come in and talk to us and sort of, you know, maybe to give us exemptions for our personnel from criminal prosecution and things like that, and just being irrelevant in spite of the great cocktail parties, while the rest of the world got down to the business of punishing criminal behavior. And that image was just so shocking to me, the idea of being left out, because we'd been doing something else, and they'd been going ahead with the business of institution building that we were once such a vital and necessary part of. So that to me is the big issue. How do we get back our soft power? How do we rejoin the world in a leadership capacity and keep other countries from doing without us and for acting as if we don't matter and for balancing against us and for creating regional sources of power and influence that won't necessarily support our own goals? We fought, easy reminder, two very expensive wars while cutting taxes. The United States, it's well to remember, had never thought of doing that before. In the Vietnam War, we didn't raise taxes, but we didn't cut taxes. And that was just one war. We fought two wars while cutting taxes. And we all know that has left us with a very big deficit and an economy that is really struggling and declining tax revenues and a cumulative debt there's a website where you can look at the debt going up by the minute. You've probably seen that, usdebt.com or something. $13 trillion in cumulative debt that we have now as a result of waging wars while cutting taxes and deregulating, which led in an important way to the global economic crash. We have yearly budget deficits of $1.4 trillion. And of course, these results undermine both our hard power, because there's simply not the kind of money to spend on military power anymore that we used to think we had, and it undermines our soft power because we don't have a lot of money to put into things like foreign aid. By deregulating and refusing to participate until Obama came along in global climate change agreements, and we finally did last year sign off on the Copenhagen Treaty, which is not very strong, but at least represented a return to U.S. participation in very important international negotiations. But by wrecking our own economy and refusing to do anything about our very high energy consumption patterns, as Richard Posner, sort of a jack of all trades intellectually, and an appellate court justice whose name you'll recognize, has recently said on his blog, I think it's amazing for a high justice on the most important appellate court to have a blog and to have opinions on almost everything. Posner writes very recently, our dependence on Chinese financing for our public debt and our increasing dependence on the Middle East for oil really handicap our soft power as well as our hard power. And it's worth remembering that as a consequence of the foreign policy of the last 8 years. We spend now over 4% of our GDP on defense, not counting veterans and interest rates and the, the probably wildly underestimated cost of taking care of those who are injured in these wars. That 4% of GDP on defense is twice the global average, and it's over 16 times the percentage of our GDP that we spend on soft power, that is, on diplomacy and foreign aid. Our foreign aid is only 0.2% of our GDP. Other democracies spend up to 1%. I think Norway is the leader, spending 1%. We spend 0.2%. If you ask Americans in surveys, what do we spend on foreign aid, the average American will respond 14%. They have a wildly exaggerated idea of what we spend on foreign aid. It's really quite tiny. And while ours has been going down, because I can remember when it used to be half a percent of GDP. Now it's down to 0.2. While ours has been going down, China's has been going up, and China has expanded, as Jonathan says, its soft power as a donor of foreign aid in Africa and Asia, and is increasingly important in that respect. So it's, again, we're going in opposite directions from our perceived most important rival. We spend under $50 billion a year for diplomacy and international organizations and foreign assistance altogether versus $700 billion for military spending. And if you add all the veterans and debt, interest payments and so on, it's even higher than that. So our hard power has been so much more emphasized than our soft power, and we refuse to join budding international institutions that went ahead and formed without us. So what has happened to our public opinion? You have this lovely color handout, which I invite you to look at to see what the trends are. I always think when I look at these surveys that the happiest country in the world must be Germany, which is now the most popular country in the world. Things have changed, and it must be very gratifying. We're sort of a middling country in terms of public opinion, and things have certainly gone up. But you can see from the tracking in these polls what happened to public opinion of the United States from 1999 to 2000, which was a relative high point. And you see that the decline, if you look at this favorable opinion of the United States, you see the drop even among our allies. It is not just in the Muslim countries where public approval of the U.S. really fell into a black hole. Even among our allies, there's a 20 to 30% drop in approval. In very important Muslim countries that are democracies, Indonesia and Turkey, you can see a pretty sharp drop there. And I imagine the Turkish one has even continued to fall. This is not something that we should not worry about. So many advisors in the Bush administration seem to believe that, you know, who cares if they love us so long as they fear us. But I think the most IR specialists would say, no, it's really very important that people have a positive view of U.S. leadership and that the trend not be going down. There is a nice color chart on page 2. If you follow where the U.S. is, it's not quite as easy to distinguish those numbers, but the U.S. line is, I would say, that's purple. You see the drop down to the bottom in 2007, and then it has slowly gone up to about 40%. And just since 2008, clearly the election of Obama has had a positive effect. His rhetoric and his outreach and the embrace of a different kind of foreign policy has certainly facilitated some improvement in the approval rating of the United States. But where do we go from here? And what do we do about the military side of our foreign policy? What I see is a tremendous constraint on hard power, and many countries in the world might say, well, good, that's good. They won't be able to afford two wars at the same time anymore. But there may be times when we feel that we need to exercise hard power, and yet, if you look at that pie chart, the last graph that you have there, and compare it with the inflation-adjusted defense spending, this is not a sustainable pattern. We're spending almost half of the discretionary budget, that is the non-entitlement budget, entitlements being, of course, mainly Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, almost half of all the rest of things we spend money for is occupied by military spending. That will have to be cut, I would think, and Obama has not yet talked about cutting it. There are some weapon systems that the Pentagon would like to get rid of. We have over 700 bases around the world, 700 bases. Will some of those need to be closed? Will we really go ahead with missile defense, which has been a bone of contention with the Russians? To me, this is possibly very ominous. Again, I think the rest of the world would say, look, they're not going to be able to afford to be clobbering other countries all the time and exercising preventive war power. So they may see that as good, that our hands are tied, that we're constrained by this budget. But I think this is the biggest issue we have not yet confronted. We're having to confront all the things we didn't do during the Bush administration. We didn't regulate finances. We'll have to do that again. We didn't regulate environmental degradation. Now we're going to have to do that again. But what about military spending? What about a smart military policy? To me, that's the largest issue that has not yet been addressed, and I imagine the rest of the world has some interest in addressing it. Thank you.
Well, I thank Jonathan and Elizabeth for two very stimulating sets of comments. They were remarkably concise and kept within the time limit, more or less. I didn't have to intervene whatsoever, and I'm keen to open things up. What I might do is just use my moderator's prerogative to pose one or two questions while you get yours ready, and then maybe invite the two of you if you have a question for each other as well. And I guess a question that I have for you, Jonathan, is you use the phrase learning moment in your talk. And the question that I have is whether the United States has done enough to make economic security a kind of organizing principle in terms of its larger foreign policy. If you get a group of foreign policy experts together in a room like this, you'll have lots of discussions of Iran and what to do about Iran. You'll have discussion about Afghanistan, about Iraq, about nuclear proliferation. You'll have obviously a lot of discussion about terrorism. Do we have enough both in that kind of a setting, but more importantly in terms of senior U.S. officials and administration thinking, are we doing enough to make economic security front and center? Even terrorism, it seems to me, even 9/11, had, though it had an economic impact, one could say it was a bit of a blip, at least for the sake of argument. And we are arguably reduced to being a phenomenal military power still in terms of our superiority in that area. Is there enough being done in terms of economic security?
No.
That should not have been a yes and no question. What might one do to rectify this situation?
Sure. I was just kidding, but I think it's. I think no is the accurate answer. The great crisis. The crisis may not be the right word. The great moment that will define, in my view, if I may wax pompously for a moment, the historical legacy of the Obama administration will be if, after the recovery, and I do think in the popular press, it's premature how quickly people are turning on this problem. I think that we still have a ways to go before we can stop fretting about the recession and start worrying about the recovery. But in the moment of the recovery, like Nixon going to China, Obama, the Democrat, will have the opportunity to take on entitlement reform and structural deficits and the U.S. debt, and he either will or he won't. And I think if he does, then we would be more toward that road of economic security, or taking seriously the idea of economic security that you suggested. And if he does not, then I think that we'll be kicking the can down the road and accrue more and more economic problems in the coming 5, 7, 10, 20 years beyond that.
Elizabeth, a question for you, and then I'm done for the moment. You referred to a different kind of foreign policy, I think was the phrase you used, under Obama. And I guess my question is a skeptical one, or how would you respond? And I will not make this a yes and no, yes or no question. How would you respond to the argument that, in fact, it's not really a new kind of foreign policy? We had Andrew Bacevich here in the spring in an event co-sponsored by the Einaudi Center. Andy was certainly skeptical that in concrete terms a lot had changed. And he, of course, singled out the escalation in Afghanistan, which he, even as a conservative, found, shall we say, lamentable. And he said that, in fact, when you think about Washington and how foreign policy in Washington is made, very little, in fact, has changed, or at least it's premature to talk about a change, so that one can speak, as you did powerfully, about a new public opinion, about an improved American standing. One can talk about the Obama administration's and Obama's personal and, I think, sincere commitment to multilateralism and to emphasizing soft power. But when it comes right down to it, have we seen, no, to what extent have we seen an important change?
No, we haven't. That's a very good question. And one really could put aside the hope and the assumptions that Democrats are back in power, have returned to Wilsonianism, there being those two great models of American foreign policy, Rooseveltian, that's Teddy Rooseveltian, unilateralism versus the Democratic Wilsonianism that have sort of contended with each other over the years. And a lot of that maybe really just is an assumption on our part, maybe that those blips up in public approval and declines in disapproval, equally important, that you see in those survey tables may just be based on hope and wishful thinking. If you look at what has actually been done, there really is a lot of continuity with the Bush administration. Willingness to use indefinite detention of prisoners. One of the surprises for me was the unwillingness to let go of extraordinary extraordinary rendition of prisoners, the claims of secrecy when people challenged the extraordinary renditions of some quite innocent people who were snatched out of airports and tortured and sent to Syria to be tortured for you. And the U.S. uses, you know, national secrecy prerogatives to try to keep those things out of court, and seems to defend them and not to be unwilling to say that we're going to give up on things like that. One can say a lot of that is playing to a domestic audience, which can be very critical of any weakness on the part of the president. But still, from the perspective of the rest of the world, which is one thing I wanted to emphasize in my remarks, there's not so much change there as they would like to see. The expanded war in both Iraq and Afghanistan, the use of predator drones, which is really causing a decline in approval of the U.S. in Pakistan, because a lot of civilians are being killed in what is a in a very scary and ominous way. You hear that sound and you duck for cover and you don't know if they're going to hit a wedding party or a funeral or just a house full of people sleeping in the night, because the information on the coordinates being monitored on a computer screen back in Arizona could be wrong. And I read about one of the women monitoring those computer screens after she realized they were calling in a strike on the wrong building, and she was saying to the screen, "Run, run, run for your lives!" But they were asleep; they couldn't run. And it's very, very poignant and very terrifying. But I think the use of predator drone is a good name, but trying not to commit your own soldiers and to keep down your own injuries, and you use these really ominous high tech modes of killing, that isn't going over very well. We're maintaining so far our bases, and in the Muslim world, there's a real reluctance to see that we're doing anything different. And of course, one has to always to acknowledge that in the Muslim world, support for the Israeli occupation and unwillingness to criticize Israel is always a big downer for them. And the most recent episode sort of brought home the continuity there.
Jonathan, you want
to? Yes, I wanted to take a panelist prerogative and ask you the question that you posed, because is one of our leading historians of post-war U.S. foreign policy. I wrote down the question you asked Elizabeth on my own piece of paper in response to her talk, and I want to direct it at you. I look at U.S. foreign policy from, say, around the turn of 1970, when it was decided that the withdrawal, slower, faster, from Vietnam would take place, through today, 40 years later. Aside from the Iraq War, I don't see basic decisions being made in a partisan way, that there seems to be an enormous amount of kind of continuity across partisan administrations in the practice of U.S. foreign policy.
I would agree with you, Jonathan, and I would say, however, that there is an important partisan element to what you've described, to this continuity. And I think, in fact, it may help us understand the fundamental continuity in the Obama administration's foreign policy. And what I mean by that is that what we find in the Cold War, and what I argue in a co-authored book on the Cold War that I wrote along with Campbell Craig and came out last year, is that, in fact, what savvy politicians learned from a very early point in the Cold War was that the savvy political position to hold was one that was to the right of your opponent, or at least was on a more hawkish direction. Maybe we shouldn't put it in terms of left and right. And that because, at least we argued in the book, the United States enjoyed through the Cold War a fundamental physical security, politicians had the luxury of playing politics with foreign policy. I don't think that really changed. I think one could make a pretty good argument, Jonathan, that Obama chose escalation in Afghanistan, at least in the short term, for domestic political reasons and to strengthen his own position, partly in order to allow him then to diffuse the issue so that he could focus on domestic priorities, but also, I think, to position himself both in terms of the 2010 midterm elections and also his re-election in 2012. I think that the decision to escalate U.S. involvement in Afghanistan is it's a difficult one to understand in geopolitical terms for all the reasons that we could discuss. It's much more understandable in domestic political terms, all of which is one way of saying, I guess, Jonathan, that I concur with your judgment that there's been, and your judgment, Elizabeth, in your answer, that there's been more continuity here than one might have expected in 2009, notwithstanding some of the changes. I want to say, and maybe this is a slight contradiction, I do think Obama's emphasis on diplomacy, his willingness to engage not just with allies but with adversaries, is an important step. It might still bear fruit, and I do think it's an important change from the previous administration. I think we should open it up to all of you. And here's what I would just say, that it would be helpful, since I see several hands already, if you keep it to a question. rather than a speech. And then we'll allow our panelists more time to respond. And I don't know if we're doing, we're not doing mics or anything, are we? No. Okay. Yes, right here in the back.
That's a good and important question. I think what we don't see as much of from the American perspective is that in China, much of what matters about the exchange rate has to do more with its stability than with its value. And I do believe, although this is a minority view, that it's that fight over liberalization versus stability that the U.S. and China are going to fail to disagree on. Partially, I think, that's because China is concerned about what you suggest, which is that instability on these external accounts and on the exchange rate could have considerably negative effects on the domestic economy. And China's economy is growing and such a pell-mell and hectic way, this kind of external anchor is very attractive in that regard. So in that sense, I do think that they can manage their economy even with an exchange rate that is different in a sustained way from what an economic model might consider to be its equilibrium exchange rate.
Yes, there's two there. Let's take one after the other.
Alexander Hamilton liked the idea that the debts of the United States would be consolidated so that the Europeans would be able to cheer us on because we would owe them money. Don't you think that our relationship with China, with holding as much of our debt as they do now, actually encourages them to cheer for our success and not move towards our failure?
I think it gives them a vested interest in our not coming to pieces. I think that that will fall short of cheering.
Could I just add that I think that there is a dependence there that some IR scholars are worried about, that because we are so dependent on China, we can't press them as much as we might otherwise do on issues regarding North Korea and Iran and Pakistan and so on. So there's an implicit weakness in that dependency.
Yes.
I appreciate your critique. It's something that's been bothering me, and if I'm all wet on this, I think I'd be much relieved. I picture a time when China will actually get really irritated. And that we have become so dependent on them to finance our deficit, and that even a hint on their part of a slight change in the mix of their investment portfolio would create, and actually there have been some instances where that's what has happened, would create real instability and would actually, in the short term, maybe financially hurt China as far as their staggering surplus of our dollars. My theory is that in our Western mentality, we see the almighty dollar as being the be-all and end-all, and that might not just be what's so important to them at a certain point in time. So I appreciate your
question. Sure.
I share your pessimism, but my pessimism derives from different sources. I have no doubt that China is not necessarily going to be become more irritated at the U.S., but will become more irritating. That's what countries do when they become great powers. They become more irritating. And I think that we, if you check Elizabeth Sanders' tables on popularity, in the next 20 years, China's popularity will decline because people just don't like arrogant emerging powers. And so we can expect what we consider to be awful trouble and what China considers to be a lack of adequate deference and respect to their emerging influence in the coming years. However, I do not think that they will find it in their interest to damage the U.S. economy in the ways that you suggest, for two reasons. One is that their entire, well, it's the two answers together, their entire economic model depends on currently exports, and it depends on currently robust U.S. demand. Dollar depreciation is not something they would find attractive, and a collapse in U.S. consumer demand is not something they would find attractive. And so for their own self-interest, even as the U.S. and China find each other increasingly self-righteously irritating over the coming years, I do not believe China will nevertheless find it in its interest to do so, because I think it's rare in international politics that countries make big decisions based on pique. Well, they might. You do put your finger on a much more interesting puzzle or phenomenon that may occur in world politics. In the 20s and 30s, France found itself with the ability to draw gold from the Bank of England whenever it was irritated with Britain. And it tried to do this. It didn't try and destroy the international monetary system, but whenever it was fighting with Britain, it would draw gold. And this was France's way of saying, oh, see, you are making us upset. And it would try and, you know, affect policy through this lever. Now, I do think it is very likely that what you say could be true, which is that China may come to think of itself as having the ability to modulate its purchases of U.S. securities and to manipulate its overall portfolio of assets in the way that's designed to get the political attention of the U.S. That seems very plausible to me. The French helped to destroy the interwar international monetary system in their failed efforts at this. And conceivably, China, if you view this as kind of like juggling knives, you know, you don't want the knife to plunge into your chest, you know, you're just trying to do a really cool trick. And in their efforts at subtle diplomacy, this may have unintended catastrophic consequences, but I do think they would be unintended catastrophic consequences of that.
I think we should have Jonathan do all of his answers from now on with his French accent. Or can you do Swedish? That's the one I'd really like to hear. The former director of the Einaudi Center, Nick, and then the gentleman in front. Nick von der Waal.
Yeah, it's good that you talked about France for a second there, because it seems to me the story of the summer is both the collapse of the euro, the collapse of the exchange rate, and potentially the collapse of the institution. The Chinese are quite happy with their dollars right now, happier than they've been for a long time, because relative to the two other potential reserve currencies, the dollar's appreciated by 40%, I think. So I'm curious what your take is on the euro crisis and what this implies in the long run for what the things that you've been discussing.
I think you've put your finger on a very important phenomenon. I've been engaged in debates over the future of the dollar, and there are a number of very distinguished scholars who have argued that the dollar will be just fine, and part of the reason they have argued that is for reasons you've suggested, which is that the euro, everyone talks about the euro as potentially being the first potential peer competitor to the dollar, and that this is novel, and now we have seen an exposure of the weakness in the euro. So the question is, the old joke about you don't have to be faster than the bear, you have to be faster than your companion, who will otherwise be eaten by the bear. And so in that sense, the dollar, for the dollar, its best hope is that the euro was always not, from an economic perspective, what would have been called an optimal currency area, and therefore had these inherent problems associated with it, further exacerbated by the technical problem of the absence of a collective fiscal policy, which prevented redistribution of labor migration across the various parts of the region to make that system work more efficiently. At a practical level, going back to the comments that I was talking about, the consequential depreciation of the euro has made the likelihood of exchange rate conflict between the U.S. and China even more likely. And that's because before the current euro crisis emerged, You could see, and I'm not a China expert who spends time in Beijing and speaks to leaders, but you could see in the popular press reporting of conflicts within Chinese elites about whether it was now time to accommodate a greater amount of Chinese appreciation, the bankers acknowledging this and other sectors in China's government industry being opposed to it. But then you kind of got the sense that, at least in this phase of exchange rate conflict, China was going to come around. There was going to be some sort of notable appreciation because you could see the domestic politics shifting there. China exports a lot to Europe, and what they have therefore witnessed in the depreciation of the euro is what, to their eyes, a rather large appreciation of the RMB on world markets generally. And therefore, when they're having a conversation with the U.S. about exchange rate realignment post-euro crisis as opposed to pre-euro crisis, their attitude has changed considerably. And I think that the heels will dig in more forcefully. So it's there's a lot of moving parts here with this euro crisis. You know, on the one hand, it does seem to make the dollar look more viable than it did simply in comparison. But on the other hand, it has this negative effect, I think, on exchange rate conflict between the U.S. and China. We'll see what Congress looks like after the 2010 election. But this easy political fight between more nativist elements of American society and China over trade is a potential event coming down the pipeline. And that will be, in my view, a very intractable and possibly nasty trade conflict.
All comments are welcome. I'm wondering what your views are on how U.S. domestic politics and the underlying interests behind the politics are likely to sort out the trade-offs that we ultimately strike in the future on investments in hard power versus soft power. And I'm just struck, of course, by statistics, which I think we had some inkling of, but they're pretty striking on the page. Military spending, both as a fraction of tax revenue in the U.S. and compared to other countries, it just seems like there's a much larger domestic political economic stake in the hard power aspect. And I wonder, apart from a few enlightened academics and policy wonks in Washington, what reason do we have to believe that this balance would ever change, even though it might be, as an economic proposition, much more effective dollar for dollar to invest a bit more in diplomacy and, as you were alluding to, foreign aid in your comments?
Oh, boy, that's a very good question. I was thinking as when the subject of Europe came up and the economic distress there, and which is something we share. There are two things we share with Europe right now, and one is the need to recreate a system of financial regulation, and hopefully they would like us to do that in coordination with them. And then there's the purely domestic struggle that you can see emerging in all the mature democracies to get a handle on social expenditures, on pensions and things. Certainly in New York State, we can sympathize with that. We have those problems in spades. But how do you tackle those problems when you've got so much domestic polarization? The Republican Party right now, which I certainly agree with Fred that you know, staying in Afghanistan, expanding the wars, not giving up on torture, that a lot of these things are really playing to one's opposition. And as you say very presciently, I think just, you know, trying to get through the 2010 elections because those midterm elections could really cripple what Obama and the Democrats want to do in the subsequent 2 years moving up to his reelection. So they just desperately want to hang on to a congressional majority, and that means making a lot of compromises. But it's so difficult domestically to deal with these problems of cutting defense spending and cutting entitlements when the two parties are so extraordinarily polarized. And the Republican opposition is in a sort of peculiar position of, remember how they sort of sabotaged health care spending controls with all the, you know, the death panels and the, you know, unplugging granny rhetoric and so on, as if they don't think we need to cut back on our health care and Medicare spending. And of course, they also very much don't want to cut back on military spending because the Republican Party has really, the center of gravity has really moved, you know, since 1980, really moved to the Sun Belt. And that's where the military spending goes in large measures. So there's a real conundrum there. You know, how do you tackle those problems given domestic politics? Europe may be in a much easier position than we are.
I would just add that, you know, Dwight Eisenhower in January of 1961 warned against the military-industrial complex, complex that he, and he later kind of admitted that he himself had played some role in creating and had benefited from. But that complex, and I think what Eisenhower foresaw in that farewell address, what is it now, 50 years ago, was that that complex could become increasingly powerful, could drive decision-making with respect to spending, certainly, but also, indeed, foreign policy decisions, would ultimately, to go to your question, would ultimately, I think he believed, have a tendency to certainly favor hard power over soft power. And what's ironic about this, because I don't think it's changed, I think in many, I think Elizabeth is right, is that, you know, the Cold War, the great confrontation that lasted almost half a century after World War II, was really won much more by soft power and America's and the West's advantages in soft power than it was in terms of this enormous expenditure in military in the military. But it's a very good question. I think one could certainly be dubious about the prospects for early change. Jonathan used the phrase vested interest. An awful lot of vested interests in this country have a stake in perpetuating this system as it is currently. Yes, right in the front.
Sorry,
just the lady in the front, and then I'll come to you. Yes.
I'm not sure if this is relevant, but back to the euro. I wonder what you see as the future of the euro. Sweden is a member of the EU, but does not have the euro. And with the new elections in England, the Conservative Party is against the euro. So what do you see as the future of the euro itself, and more than that, perhaps, of the EU?
Well, Jonathan is going to come with a humdinger of an answer in just a second to your question, but I'll give him just a moment to prepare and say that in my native, I'm originally from Sweden, and I pay attention to Swedish politics, and there's an election coming up in the fall, and the leaders, really of all the major parties in Sweden are, I think, hedging with the possible certainly the key players in all of the in the main parties are now hedging on whether Sweden should join the currency. There was much more support for that proposition, I think, on the part of many analysts in Sweden than there is now, given some of the problems that the euro has encountered. And the Swedish economy, at least up to now, has done comparatively well compared to its European partners.
I don't know. The problem is that as an economic entity, the euro never really made sense. To have that currency in that economic space was relatively inefficient. But it was part of a much larger project than about economic efficiency. It was about efforts to forge this European identity, part of a extraordinarily remarkable and successful political experiment stretching back over 50 years, which has worked if you compare the past 50 years of European history with a couple of hundred years before that. From here, what has been exposed, I think, are these structural inefficiencies of having the common currency with the uncommon elements remaining in the economies. And so the crisis that Europe will face will either be to allow the euro to come apart or retreat to a core of smaller countries. And hope that they can sustain this identity project with a core and affiliates, or that they will seize upon this crisis moment to try and institutionally deepen other elements of European economic integration to make the problems that emerge from the current euro crisis less likely to emerge in the future. That would be a dramatic, if not revolutionary, undertaking with regard to, in particular, fund sharing across different governments. Europe's gotten a lot bigger, has more members than it used to. This, I don't know, I'm not enough of a specialist in European politics to know how easy that would be to sell. But I do think the prior road is not likely sustainable, that it will either have to devolve into a core Eurozone plus, or they will have to move forward yet another step in this dramatic identity project in which national identities become less important and a European identity becomes more important. Which one will happen, I have absolutely no idea.
Yes.
So the prior general had asked my question about the military spending, but this faces two, cutting military spending faces two hurdles. One is a shift away from a hawkish position, which sounds to me to be the easier step. The other step is there is hardly a congressional district in the entire United States that does not have a factory or a military base to defend. So it's not partisan. It's both sides of the aisle. And also, it has become such a huge part of the economy that any attempt to cut this is going to be seen as a recessionary action. How do we combat those problems?
That's a very good point, Elizabeth. Should answer. I would say that you put your finger on something very important, and this is true, I think, going back at least to the end of World War II, that there are powerful interests in Washington pushing for a continual expansion of that military establishment for the reasons that you've outlined, and probably for other reasons as well. And very few organizations, if any, that argue the opposite. That you have not historically had interest groups that argue for reducing our dependence on the military instrument, shifting resources to other parts of the American economy. That has never been a particularly, it's not been a winning argument, and it's been very difficult for organizations to make that argument. Would you agree?
And yet, there is a ray of hope. I would point you to the top set of graphs, the green, yellow, black, and turquoise ones on page 3. We have been able to cut military spending with all those relationships and all that lobbying and all that district economic benefit in place, and even in the midst of recession in the 1970s. I think it was easier in the 1990s because the country was so prosperous that people didn't hang on so desperately to the production of a jet fighter the Pentagon wanted nothing to do with. And that does make it harder now. But if you look at those two dips in the 70s after the Vietnam War and in the 90s after the end of the Cold War, it has been possible. But I would say in the second case, well, the two cases are interesting. I could say so much about them, but in terms of domestic politics. But let me just say that in the second side, when Clinton presided over a diminution of military spending, there was one very unfortunate result. And it's something that we haven't even talked about yet, but and maybe we don't need to. Maybe it's not that important. What Clinton did to cut the military budget domestically was to help the defense production industry by exporting U.S. military equipment like crazy, doing away with a lot of controls. We really became the arms seller to the world, sine qua non. And that had a lot of unfortunate effects on conflicts around the world. So that was a solution that maybe doesn't recommend itself.
Here's what I'm going to propose. We have about 5 minutes. Why don't we take two or three questions all together, which will force you guys to have good memories or take notes, and then we'll give you guys a chance to answer. Let's begin with the gentleman here in the hat. Yes.
Yes, I want to make a statement first. I spent 30 years or more working in high-tech consumer product manufacturing, electronics. When I started out, the U.S. was number one, just about. And as far as our relevance today is, we're about under Singapore and a little above Bangladesh. So we've kind of dropped in relevance. So at what point will we, or maybe at what point did we become a second world power instead of a first world power?
Okay, hold on. Yes, at the very back.
If you look at what happened with the waning of Britain's power through the two world wars, and then after that, Britain suffered a lot, but most of the suffering, I think, resulted from the excesses in the use of power rather than from the loss of power. Implicit in both of your talks was the assumption that American power is desirable. But is America really going to suffer that much as a result of the loss of power? Or it seems like it's going to suffer more as a result of the excesses that came out of that power.
And one more. Was there one right here? Toward the back?
Well, yeah, but it's totally unrelated, so I think I'll pass.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I think we're going to, because we're more or less out of time, what I will do is hold it here, give our speakers a chance to respond, and then I'll just have a closing comment. Who wants to?
I'll go.
I can uncharacteristically respond to both of those questions by doing something strange, which is quoting Margaret Thatcher. Who came over here and said when we were feeling quite malaise with ourselves, she said, "Cheer up, America." I can't, my French is much better than my French. And Thatcher was right. Sam Huntington, not someone who I have a tremendous amount of intellectual affinity with, was right in the 80s when he wrote of wave upon wave of American declinism that he could point out. In this decade, they said we were going to decline. In this decade, they said we were going to decline. That there's always been, from an American perspective, a bit of an obsession with the idea that we're declining. I don't think, based on the raw materials, that is the U.S. economy and American capacity, that there's not anything going on within the United States that cannot be fairly well fixed. The U.S. economy, we've talked a lot about its weaknesses, has an enormous number of tremendous strengths. We might want to remind ourselves that it is kind of the world's largest economy, and we talk about China as a import market for the world's goods. Obviously, number one remains the U.S., and you could make a list of all of the continuing positive attributes of the U.S. economy. The crisis is not in what America has, whether it's falling behind, whether it's catching up, or this or that. It is, as Elizabeth suggested in her comments, or perhaps not suggested, but said in her comments, which is, does the political system of the United States, as it is currently operating, have the functional capacity to put forth the fairly straightforward, if difficult, solutions that exist to those not insurmountable problems that it currently has? It's really a crisis not of the fading of America in its economy, in its innovation, in the skill of its people. The great crisis the U.S. faces and the greatest threat to the types of broad security you talked about, Fred, have to do with the crisis in its political functioning. And that's where we'll see all of this play out, I think.
Elizabeth, is American power a good thing? Is the projection of that power a good thing for America?
I think we've played a much more positive role in the world and in our Wilsonian side, than our Teddy Rooseveltian side. I think the rest of the world would agree with that, and that we have such a lot to offer if we began to emphasize again multilateralism and creativity and diplomacy and peace and helping the world. Gosh, I mean, we could certainly set a good example if we cooperated with other countries in trying to address the big problems of mature capitalism, of entitlements and regulation and so on. And we have been a role model before, and maybe we can be again.
Well, there is a lot more that could be said, and I do see several hands up that I can't call on, unfortunately. But I think what I can say is that we have touched on important issues today that will remain with us. It's possible that one or two of our speakers will remain behind for a moment or two if those of you who didn't get called on want to pose a question. What I'd like to do is encourage you when you leave to stop by the tables outside. There is literature, a brochure that gives a sense of what the Einaudi Center has done, even in the midst of an economic downturn. We've been able to keep breadth and a range of programs. What I want to do now, however, is to first thank all of you for coming, and then ask you to join me in thanking our two panelists this afternoon.
We could be Cuban and applaud ourselves.